Welcome to Dividend Talk Podcast, episode number 14, Portfolio Management. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Dividend Talk. I'm your co-host, Engineer My Freedom, and today I'm joined with European DGI. This is a podcast where we discuss our passion for dividend growth investing with our own unique European flavour. If you're new to this channel, please hit the like button and subscribe to us. And check out our previous episodes on YouTube and Spotify. See you on the inside. Man, this feels weird. It's a Monday night and we're recording Dividend Talk, usually here on a Friday night. So apologies to all our listeners who have been DMing me, but EDGI, how have you been?
I've been good. Had a, let's say, an off topic on Friday. So it was a lot of liquid involved and not so much sleep. So it's good that we have it on Monday evening now.
Plenty of time to recover. But I'm excited about this podcast. We have the winner of our Dividend Talk quiz, Phil, with us today. And I should mention that he won the quiz, even though I participated. I wrote 50% of these questions and still came second. So he's the worthy winner, and this is why we have him on the podcast today. So, Phil, for anyone that doesn't know you, please introduce yourself.
Yes, hello. So my name is Phil. I'm originally from Germany, but I moved to Brussels, Belgium. And yeah, no worries, it was not about the politics. I'm hardware engineer, electrical engineer, and I'm here in the sales department of a multinational.
Nice. And so you're electrical engineer. I didn't know that. I'm an electrical engineer as well. I've kind of divvied into automation a little bit, but that's quite interesting. So tell us a little bit more then about yourself and from an investment point of view, or little overview of what we're going to talk about today, I suppose.
Okay. Yeah, so my investment background is actually pretty short. So I'm invested now since roughly 5 years. Before that, I mean, it was pretty obvious, you know, German education, you should save your money. But yeah, in the end, what do you do with it? So yeah, I had a hard start with getting invested. We do not have a lot of, knowledge in our family about this topic. So I read a lot of books and got some advice from friends, and I somehow started, but definitely without any vision, without any big picture in mind what it should look like. So yeah, that's why I put portfolio managers for sure an important topic.
And all this research must have did you well, if you can beat me in a quiz that I half wrote. You must have learned a thing or two. So usually at this point, what we do is we just give you 5 rapid fire questions, just to let our audience get to know you a little bit. It's a little bit of fun. And you can clarify 2 of those answers if you wish at the end. So I think EDGI has prepared these, so let him fire away.
Yes. Let's start with the rapid fire round. I'm curious to how you will do it. And in the end, you may clarify 1 or 2 of the answers. So the first one, business school or an engineering degree?
Engineering degree, by heart.
2, Microsoft or Apple?
Microsoft.
3, a rich partner now or a self-made richness 10 years from now?
The second one, self-made rich in the future.
Okay. Next one, climate change or the wealth gap?
Oh, good one. Good one. I would say, oh no, that's so mean. Can I skip this one?
No.
Wow. That's a tough one. I would say climate change.
Okay, thank you. The last one is even tougher. Germany, when they won the World Cup in 1974 or in 1990?
1990.
Good, thank you. Would you like to clarify one of your answers?
Okay, yeah, the first one with engineering degree versus business degree. I mean, yeah, I'm engineer by heart. So that was an easy one for me. But I think it's still a little bit, you know, about the mindset of a person. I mean, it does not matter in the end what kind of educational background you have. It's something about personality, and yeah, something that's inside of you. I think it anyway will come to the surface with a good education.
Yeah, I agree. But being an engineer definitely helps. I just want to say that.
Why were you doubting about climate change versus the wealth gap?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, I do not want to have both. I mean, climate change, yeah, it's an ugly one. It can become an ugly one. Wealth gap, it's not fair. So that's when I was in between the two. I mean, I would not want to have any of them. In the end, I would say if we solve the wealth gap, maybe we can solve climate change altogether.
Yeah.
So that was the idea. But it was a tough one.
It's great to have an optimistic person on the show.
Yes.
Okay. So thank you, Phil. We will get back later to the main topic. So I'm now very interested in if one of you picked up something in the news this week, which you would like to share. Maybe EMF, start with you.
Yeah, of course, I go first. So one thing that stuck out for me was, it, from an Irish perspective, I suppose, is banks over here are now starting to cap on savings. And I believe that's quite significant. The cap at the moment, I think, is $500,000, which is way outside my reach and most people that I know reaches. But the fact that the banks are bringing in this cap now, I can see this being reduced over time down to a level that will probably impact a lot more people. So it's for me, it's definitely an incentive to make your money work for you a little bit more. Just keep it out of the banks, keep what you need. But it should hopefully incentivize people to maybe start investing or looking at ways of making their money either work or protecting their money and protecting their assets. So it's only something new to come into Ireland. One bank is looking at the owners. They haven't brought it in yet, but as soon as the first bank does, I'm sure it'll trickle the whole way through.
Cool. I hear this more often. And now there are also, for instance, some banks are capping the limits on the rates itself, as an example, or they even minus. Yeah, so I think we're just at the end of this kind of debt cycle and such, and we're really stretching our bandwidth when it comes to a low interest environment. I mean, how much do you still want to support purchasing assets? And maybe we should just at a certain moment just all together say, okay, let's swallow this pill. Let's just get over it. Let's recalibrate and move on after that. I still have a feeling that we haven't paid the bill for the Great Recession back in 2008. And we're just postponing all the time using some financial engineering. So yeah, it doesn't look rosy if I hear this kind of news.
Yeah, certainly tough times ahead. How about you? Have you heard that in the news, or what kind of stuck out for you?
Well, for me, it was just a bit popcorn time with Nikola, this car manufacturing that is trying to challenge Tesla, I guess. And actually, today we were talking also about something else on Twitter a little bit, but it reminds me just something like Theranos that was having this blood sampling device designed and trying to sell it already. They were pretty far in the prototype and everything, and in selling it. They had already deals, I think, with CFS and such, really in the shop, but they were just faking everything. And I have this feeling a little bit with Nikola as well, and maybe they try to get out of it still with getting some technology quickly from GM or something like that. But it sounds a little bit like a fake it till you make it approach. Hey, it might work, but for me it's something to stay away from. But I just like these kinds of stories because, I mean, my heart starts beating faster as an investor. Yeah, I'm passionate about investing. So this is typically popcorn time when I read this. So I'm keeping a close eye on the story, but I'm staying away with my money.
So. I'd agree. It's great to sit back and watch, but there's no way I'm putting money anywhere near. So how about you, Phil? Is there anything in the news that you want to speak about?
Yes, it was basically an article that I found on Bloomberg. Yeah, it's not necessarily tied to last week, but something that happened this year since the COVID-19 crisis. And it's about that a lot of wealthy families and founders are taking their companies from the stock market again. So there's this family that is heavily involved in SoftBank in Japan that thinks of taking off some equity again. Same also with a German founder, a family somewhere with Rocket Internet, so company behind Zalando, Delivery Hero. So that made me actually think a little bit. If all the wealthy people take off those companies, I mean, what do we have in the pond left? I mean, is it most likely not the biggest fish, the most profitable fish?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's very interesting because, for instance, I've been always looking at a company like LEGO. I would love to own it, but it's really hard for us to participate in that. And it is very interesting to maybe ask such a person one time, like, why are you taking it private? Yeah, is it like the shareholder pressure, the short-term focus? Does it prevent you from innovation? Those are really interesting topics, right? And yeah, cool. Thanks, Phil. So I think this is the time we could nicely go to the main topic of today, portfolio management. And maybe it would be interesting to hear from you, Phil, a little bit. Like, how do you look at portfolio management? What does it mean to you?
Yeah, I think portfolio management is for sure a very broad topic. I mean, it can be everything from how to build up your portfolio with the typical questions of asset allocation, sector allocation, country allocation. But then, in my phase of investing, I think it's a little bit more about how to maintain how to maintain your portfolio. So I think also a very important topic. And to be honest, I see a lot of literature and a lot of, blogs about how to or when to buy companies. But in the end, what do you do when you keep them? I mean, will you add up? Will you add up in new ones or in the ones that you have? So I think it's definitely something you should think about. Also up front.
So EMF, how are you doing that? How are you maintaining your portfolio? I believe you're also actually looking into this topic at the moment, right?
Yeah, for me, and I think I spoke before a little bit about it. I started investing and I was following, the dividend growth investor, and I had so many companies that, one, I did not know what they did, and two, I had one or two shares of them, and I had no reason for them to be in my portfolio. So I kind of took a step back and I began thinking about how I want to structure my portfolio going forward. I have used a little bit of inspiration from you. I know you have different tiers and I'll have different levels, I suppose, in my portfolio, but I've come to the conclusion of kind of eight banks of four. So 32 companies is more than enough for me. I mean, I don't need too many more than 32 companies. So after that, I may add more in the future, but I really want to build my core, see my top tier companies first and build out from there. So that's where I am with it at the moment. It's still a work in progress. I've made a lot of sales in August and September, and I've really reinvested that money then into my top tier companies. I'm starting to buy some Microsoft, starting to buy ADP and ABV and stuff like that. So there's definitely a shift in how I'm actually looking at my portfolio at the moment.
Yeah. And Phil, I believe you're going through a similar thought process. And I wanted to ask you, how do you deal then with the urge when new companies suddenly pop up? Like, let's say that I write about an interesting European dividend company with a rich history, and you see it on other blogs also popping up. How do you deal with such an urge? Because that's usually for me the issue, right? Okay, I've got my cap on 40 stocks and suddenly I see this wonderful post, I do my own analysis and everything is rosy and shiny. How do you then, because that's where the maintenance later kicks in, right? It's rather first the prevention of not letting your portfolio mushroom.
Okay, yeah, that's really a difficult one. What I currently do is I take the two companies into one ring and let them fight against each other. And it's not and a winner takes it all. I mean, if I still want to keep the company that I had first in the portfolio, then it will stay in my portfolio. So it's not the purpose of replacing companies. It's just adding companies on top.
Yeah. And why not, for instance, betting on two horses? I mean, I just looked up a little bit this week in Trading 212. You can build your own little portfolio or ETF, invest in it at once. So why would it still matter then? You can easily have, take all the best ones from a whole sector in there.
Yeah, that's a good one. And that was my approach, let's say 2-3 years ago. But now, especially with COVID-19 candy store 1 quarter ago, I mean, I added up so many companies. But if I want to stay on track of all companies and what's happening, it's just not easy to maintain.
Yeah.
Does sector allocation come into that a little bit? I mean, if you have a specific sector allocation in mind that you want to reach, and a new company comes in that will offset that balance, how would you kind of rejig your sector in that sense?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think I would not over-engineer, to be honest. I would do how comfortable I feel with adding another company in the certain sector. But overall, yeah, my allocation strategy currently is a little bit to the one that EDGI described on his blog, with kind of an household spending approach. And yeah, in the end, if I open a new position for a company in sector XYZ, I mean, it will not with double digits influence the sector allocation. So I think a steady approach, not over-engineering things, not doing things to do things. Yeah, just keep it calm. I think that's the best approach there.
And how many companies can you handle from a, let's say, from a time perspective? Because you mentioned you want to keep track of some companies. So how much space do you have, let's say, in your head effectively to keep track of companies?
Definitely not enough to track the 44 companies that I had, let's say, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I sold already, I think, 7 companies last week to indeed get it down. And I mean, for me, I would feel comfortable with around 20 stocks.
Yeah.
And it's not that they need to be equally weighted, but I think that's something between 10 and 20 that's, I think, should be manageable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, and because I know from portfolio management theory, and it's also in the book from Ray Dalio, I think, you can really see that I think the optimum is 9 stocks, because every additional stock doesn't reduce your risk anymore from a diversification point of view. So my question is, why not 10? Why 20?
Yeah, 20 is to give me some flexibility. Let's assume that I have 10 stocks. And I mean, I still have, you know, from my financial planning quarterly, a certain amount of money, and I want to invest it somewhere. But with a lower amount of companies in the portfolio, I mean, there could be the risk that none is at a price level where I want to reinvest or to add some more money. So I want to keep some flexibility here. But indeed, also, I mean, other topic is also to spice things up a little bit. I mean, yeah, betting on two horses gives me a little bit a better feeling than betting one horse. But in the end, I fully agree. The simpler, the better. In that context, I also found a very interesting interview on YouTube with Warren Buffett. I think it was the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting in 1996, and he was talking about diversification, and he had a very interesting quote, and I will read it. Diversification is a protection against ignorance.
Yes.
That was then actually something, you know, that was like, okay, fair point. And I mean, he says later on, if you know what you're doing, you do not need a lot of companies. Why should you invest in, let's say, company on place number 11, 12, 13, 14, when you can just invest more in the top 10 or in the top 5 in that perspective? So
I fully agree with him. And that's why I have 40 companies, because I calculated for my tier one, I would, if one company will go bankrupt, I would have maximum 4% loss. So to his point, yeah, I'm ignorant about some companies in the sense of I might not have the time to go deeper than my own stock analysis. I'm not going to check if there are Porsches standing in front of the office and whether an acquisition is happening or something like that. I'm not going also in the rubbish bins there to check if there's anything that I should know, because I think that's the edge that someone like Warren Buffett has. Yeah, I'm sure that he has just people pitching to him, actually saying why they should invest. So the only thing I can use are annual reports, quarterly reports, some YouTube interviews. So yes, I am ignorant in that regard. So hence why I put the safety net in place that I would maximum lose 4%, let's say, when I have one bad actor in my portfolio and the rest would do the heavy weighting. So yeah, no, I'm fully agreeing with him on that.
Yeah, I'd agree as well, because look, we're not accountants. I mean, I look at a financial report, I learned that from a book, but some guys, they go to college, they have masters. Warren Buffett spent his whole life looking at these things, so he knows what he's looking for. I know what a certain book tells me to look for, so I would not be comfortable in having 9 stocks, because I'd probably pick 9 stocks that would underperform the market by a huge amount, and you'd have FOMO and make all sorts of silly decisions. So I'm kind of happy with 32 companies. At least it gives me diversification within a sector that even if I pick one or two bad horses, hopefully then I have a couple more that will pick up the slack. So in terms of your portfolio, do you track its performance in any way?
I did it in the past, but I do not any longer. The only thing that I do is track my monthly dividends that come in, and that's it. I found out that if I use some dedicated software, I look too much into numbers, and in the end, I do not want to work for my portfolio. I want the portfolio to work for me and keep it simple.
So you're really focused, a little bit like me, on the cash flow. Just is the cash growing that's coming in? Because that's, I guess, your ultimate goal as well.
Exactly. Exactly. So basically, I mean, I want to see results in terms of dividend, and then rather read, you know, overall news. How is an industry doing? How is a sector doing? How is a company doing? And with that, I think, you can already spend a lot of time.
Yeah. And to that point, do you buy to hold or do you buy to enjoy the ride and then sell at a certain moment? Or what makes you sell?
Yeah, it's a good one. I would describe myself as a buy and hold and check. So indeed, mm-hmm. I always want to see, are things going in the right direction? I'm not sure if I wanted to commit to a certain company like till retirement. mm-hmm. It really depends how things develop. If I see enough, you know, innovation at a company that I always or every year can say like, okay, I trust this company for the next 10 years, then I feel comfortable holding it for a very long time. If there's a moment in time where I see like, oh, okay, competition is catching up, I do not see a lot of, you know, growth vectors in the pipeline of a company, then most likely I would reconsider.
Yeah. And does tax also play in a role in your selling decision? For instance, capital gain. I actually don't know what's in Germany or in Belgium. Is it capital gain tax or wealth tax?
In Germany, it is capital gain. In Belgium, it is not.
And you're now under Belgium exactly. regime, should I say?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so then in that case, if you would sell, it doesn't really matter because you don't mm-hmm. pay capital gain tax. You only pay some wealth tax anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. It's very interesting. And so for me, capital gain tax, it does play a role when considering selling, because that means for me that I'm looking actually at about how much my stocks are overvalued. Because if they are like, let's say we pay 19% capital gain tax here, if they would be like 15% overvalued, I wouldn't sell them because I would still, you know, get less than the fair value then. So it does play a little bit of a role in there. But if a company, just like you said, doesn't apply to your thesis anymore and there are too many risks, I just sell it straight away.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bigger consideration in Ireland because we pay 33%. Capital gains tax, so it's quite a significant amount of money to pay. So we really have to consider our selling position. So when I buy, that's why I typically buy to hold. Luckily, at the moment, I made a loss on Tanger, which I've mentioned before. So the stuff that I'm selling now is covered, so I won't need to pay capital gains tax, but in future, if I was to sell a big position, it's certainly something that I'd have to strongly consider. I mean, 1/3 of your profits is a lot to pay.
Yeah. I also have actually a quite practical question. Do you hold your stocks in more than one broker, or do you have everything at the same broker? And if you use more brokers, do you use it for different purposes?
Since 2 months, I have actually 2 broker accounts. But it was not in the purpose of having 2. Was just that the broker that I chose in Belgium was bought by a different broker. You never know what happens. And that was, for me, is kind of a trigger to, you know, go with a bigger one, more international one. So I chose, in that perspective, Lynx broker that works on the Interactive Broker backend. In itself, I think, yeah, you can work with one broker account. I mean, keeping things simple, especially when you begin to build up your portfolio, just choose the one, you know, that is the most beginner friendly. Of course, fees also an important topic, but in the end, I think in the beginning, you should start with something where you feel comfortable with. And moving forward, as soon as you learn more and find out, yeah, okay, my first broker cannot buy a certain stock in a certain market, then I think you can evolve with it. And that's maybe then a good moment to think about different brokers when you understand what you are doing.
Yeah. Okay, good points. I think it's a good time to start concluding the portfolio management topic. Looking also a bit at the time. So is there any last recommendation that you would like to give to our listeners around portfolio management? Any of you, any words of wisdom?
Oh, I'm not sure if it's a words of wisdom, but the only thing is, I mean, do whatever you feel comfortable with. Some base diversification, I think, is never a bad idea, but also try to keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah. Sounds like really, really good advice and resonates a lot with me. Thanks, Phil. Okay, I think let's go to the listeners' questions. We had a few listeners' questions coming in again. And maybe this first one might be for you, EMF. So what is your view or opinion on investment trusts, such as the City of London Investment Trust? It specializes in income and has a dividend yield of almost 6%. It has management costs cumulatively from approximately 0.7% per year.
Yeah, I mean, this topic has been hopping a little bit on our WhatsApp group, this Financial Independence WhatsApp group for Ireland. I think Andrew is actually in that group. And it is definitely, for Irish investors, definitely a good a better alternative to ETFs in terms of tax. So I've mentioned before that our tax system on ETFs is quite stringent, but also we've got some rules and complications with deemed disposals and calculating our tax every 8 years, and it's quite cumbersome. And if you don't know what you're doing, or if you're not an accountant, or it can be quite hard and lots of mistakes, and you can be punished by our revenue. So the difference with investment trusts are that they are taxed like ordinary shares. So they have a lower rate of tax, the tax at your marginal rate, and you pay capital gains if you sell at 33%, as I mentioned earlier. But it's not all rosy for me. There is some things that kind of stood out for me, and one of them was that these trusts can borrow to purchase assets. I mean, that's big for me. Risk for me, I'm quite moderate, and I think as a dividend investor, it suits me. When I look at something like this, I'm thinking, okay, that's great if the fund goes well and the manager, the management borrows and everything goes up and great, you've made loads of money. But what if it goes in the other direction? It can quite easily turn sour. So that's one thing that I wasn't really comfortable with, having another manager, a manager of a fund actually borrowing to purchase assets within this fund. Yeah.
So I remember that I looked into this trust one time, and if I'm not correct, so I might be correct here, this one has decades of dividend growth behind it. So how is this different than looking at a stock to see whether management is prudent with their debt? How is it different? I mean, at least you get with a trust more diversification and more spread in risk.
Of course. And for anyone that I suppose is not comfortable in stock picking, I think this is a brilliant choice. I mean, I've done some back at a matchbook kind of calculations on the fees that you would typically pay over 5 years. And with this investment trust, I think with was it a 10K starting pot that I had, you would have paid 862 euro in fees over them 5 years. Tax on dividends. So we've got two rates. You've got 20% or 40%. So it depends on your marginal rate of what you're paying. So if you're on the 40% high income earner, you're paying 839. So it's quite close to the investment trust. So you quite matching. If you're on the lower rate, you would have that. So I would argue if you're a lower rate earner and comfortable picking stocks, certainly stock picking is the way to go. But if you are not comfortable and you're a higher rate earner, then investment trusts are probably a good option.
Yeah. Okay, cool. That's a very interesting question to answer. So let's go to the next one from Stuart. Considering the bearish direction of the market, do you think more value will be got investing monthly or weekly? And he's mentioning that he's currently putting 35 quid. I assume a quid is a pound, but then in slang, into a pie on trading 212. Maybe that's one for you, Phil. So what do you think about investing currently, knowing the bearish sentiment, monthly or weekly? What would have your preference?
Yes. In my situation, I would most likely go for monthly as of now. When we had the big COVID-19 crash, it was for me rather weekly, if not even multiple times a week. But as of now, I would say monthly is fine.
Yeah. So I think I get where the question comes from, right? Because trading 12, no commissions. So commissions don't play really an issue anymore in a purchase decision. So I get why he says on a weekly basis, you can actually dollar cost average even more. So I think it would be a good idea, but I would still do it probably in one stock. So I work in, I think the English word is tranches. So let's say that my portfolio position would be 10K for a certain stock. I will probably buy in every time 2,000 or something like that. So in that case, I would split it out then in 4 times 500 and do it like that. It might be actually a good alternative with a brokerage account of trading 212, because it just smooths it out and we're not there to time the market anyway.
Just to clarify, a quid is a pound. It's Irish slang. It's what we use. So again, another one of my Irish listeners. But I had a quick chat with Stuart on DMs with this, and for me, it doesn't really matter if you are confident that you're in a bearish market and the market is going down. I would argue that maybe monthly is a little bit better. Have your set pot and spread it out over a period of time. You're never going to hit the bottom, but you might have a better chance of at least picking up some of the lower prices.
Okay. Let's go to the third listener question. And by the way, thanks, Stuart. Good one. The Wolf of Hardcore Street. So I guess another Irish one, I believe.
Yes.
Yes. We should really send some flowers to Ireland. What portfolio management tools, website or apps do you use outside of Excel or G Sheets?
I mean, I use G Sheets almost exclusively. I do have, I think it's DivGrow. I started that before, but G Sheets is pretty much what I use. I'll put a link in the description to what I did use. I know some people on Twitter that I've sent that found it really useful because it shows you upcoming dividends, what you've been paid, and it's really useful. So I'll link that. But personally, I use G Sheets because I like being able to customize my own. Formulas. How about you, Phil?
Yeah, I can actually recommend an open source tool. It's called Portfolio Performance from a German software engineer. And open source works on all platforms that you can imagine. And also very extensive feature set. So you basically add first companies to, let's say, your company universe, and then you can do individual purchases or selling transactions. And later on, the way how you can visualize all kind of performance indicators is very impressive. I will certainly send the link. I started using this this tool a couple of years ago, but in the end, if you get then let's say a couple of dividend payments per month, can take again a lot of time putting everything in the system. And that's why I just went back to a basic Google document and just copying some numbers, and that's it.
Smart. Okay. Also here, thank you, DeWolf. Let's go to the last question. And this one is from Investment Talk, our former guest on the show. What disruptive trends are you most bullish on? Examples, payments, e-commerce, US gambling, etc. Anyone would like to go first?
For me, it's US gambling. I think I spoke before that I was involved in match betting in the UK and seeing how big that was. I mean, America is how much bigger than the UK and Ireland. So I'd imagine it will explode if that takes online. And I remember in the early days of poker before it was banned in the US, and there was millions of people online, and every hour of the day there was huge, huge money to be made. So I reckon if US gambling takes off, I reckon it'll be big business, and there'll be lots of cash flying about.
Yeah, for me, Phil. I think it's rather the e-commerce topic. I think that's definitely a little bit fueled by current situation that we face. I think it really shows if a company set up an e-commerce platform, they can withstand every problem. I mean, the ones that we currently face. I think that's a good one that already started, that already showed, okay, a company that does not have a good e-commerce platform has already an disadvantage. And yeah, there are definitely some nice companies in that sector that already skyrocketed for sure.
So I'm most bullish on companies that solve problems for data scientists. So think about the whole data engineering, the data wrangling. I think Snowflake is a really great example of that. Now, let's not talk about valuation of Snowflake, but I'm bullish on these companies. And specifically also when you look at the healthcare industry and when you think about genome profiling and then trying to find in the personalized healthcare space, try to find companies that can really bring insights in that data and really support finding new cures or increasing the patient journey. I think that's really something that I'm most bullish on. And here I would really look at kind of investing in baskets, not bet on a single company, but just compile a small basket like ARK Investment does, ARK Investment. But I think that's really big. That's really big. And I think we will see breakthroughs there. And we need several companies in that whole supply chain, and Snowflake might be one of those.
Really good. I believe there was one last question, actually. I might ask you guys. It's about fossil fuels. As big fossil fuelers move into renewables, who do you favor to lead the pack? And also, are there any straight renewable resource companies you'll invest in right now?
This is a really interesting topic, because my issue is a little bit with the renewable energy space that I don't know enough highly profitable companies in this space. I've been looking into it. It seems to be so far still often like a loss-making business. So if there's one company that I have a lot of faith in, it's in Siemens. So not rather looking at an utility kind of a company or something like Shell, but rather an equipment provider. And I think Siemens has state-of-the-art equipment here. We have also, I think, Ventas, Denmark, I believe it is. So I would rather probably at this stage go for such companies, because I believe that they have more pricing power. Although it's still like in the big, RFPs and such from governments, I still think they have more pricing power.
Yeah, I kind of agree. And there was a guy, Danny, he's a follower on both of our Twitter accounts. He wrote a nice article on Medium about Vesta about the wind systems and did all the motors and all the wind turbines. And I just remember from my days in college, we had a couple of semesters on renewable energy, and all the guys that study this, it was all about Vestas and Vestas. So he wrote a great article, and from that article, he's quite bullish on them. I know they're a great brand. So if you're looking at equipment in that sector, I would recommend checking out his article and having a look at them and seeing what you think.
Yeah, the only thing that comes up, but to be honest, I did not check the details. Have you ever heard of YieldCos? Those are the companies that apparently manage, let's say, solar parks. So they build up all the solar panels and they run them. But of course, you know in the beginning already what you pay and what you will get out of it. So it's apparently a business that you can calculate and plan very well. But I have no idea if it's sustainable and if they already make a good money or if they still lose money.
Yeah, super. Well, some very good questions today. So thank you all for bringing those in. And I'm actually personally, and I guess EMF as well, looking forward for the questions from next week. But let's go to also another favorite topic of us, and those are the stock picks. And today I would like to start with you, Phil. Do you have any favorite stock that you would like to make the listeners aware of?
Yes, definitely. It's another monthly paying REIT, and it's called Stack Industrial. It's a fairly new REIT. I think they were founded 2010. But what I really like is that they focus on light industrial and logistic properties. So they basically own the warehouses of Amazon. And I got them for a good price. So full disclaimer, during COVID, I opened a position. And I like to keep them as a second REIT position next to Realty Income.
Nice. I will check it out after this podcast straight away, because you made me curious. How about you, EMF?
Yeah, this week I went for Texas Instruments, I suppose, off the back of that huge dividend increase that they had. In our industry, in automation, I'm sure, Phil, you know, Texas Instruments play a huge part. I've spent the last 2 days working exclusively with them. So that's what picked. A little bit overvalued, mind you. This is not from a valuation point of view. I would like them a lot lower. But just as a company that I like, that's who I picked this week.
Cool. Thank you. I personally chose Red Electrica because I know we spoke about it before. And I know it's quite a popular utility in Europe to look into. So actually, after this podcast, the recording of this podcast, I'm going to hit the publish button on my blog. And I would like to raise rather a warning, because I have an opportunity to provide some narration to it as well. I went through the numbers. And I've seen several major risks there to this utility. So I like their business part of the story. But when I look at their fundamentals, I'm really getting concerned. So my recommendation, therefore, is also personally that I will not add any money to it. And for instance, two things that I really had my concerns about is it seems to that there is something with their assets that they that are older, let's say, are from before 1998. And they cannot earn revenue really anymore from it from 2024 onwards. So there's kind of a revenue cliff coming up, which might hurt their dividend. And at the same time, they have been increasing a lot their dividend. And this was on the back of the Spanish consumer by increasing prices. And now the Spanish watchdog is getting more and more complaints. Also, the rates that they are negotiating going forward are going to be lower. So I don't think they will be able to keep up this rate of dividend growth. And at the same time, their debt is quite large. It's not worrying from a debt obligation point of view. But if you then look at their valuation and you start calculating the sum of their cash flows as part of a net present value, and you deduct the debt and add the cash, then there's not a lot of left in share price there that you should really pay for it. So I just wanted to share these warnings, also a little bit in narration, because I know it's a popular stock, but my opinion is it's a yield play. But if you look a little bit further, it doesn't look so rosy. So actually the price that it went down is quite correctly so. And I think it's like Shell, like a few months ago, the yield is carrying the current price. And I'm not so much concerned about the dividend yield or the dividend safety in the upcoming 3-4 years. But after that, if this management doesn't come with proper plans to mitigate the revenue, then I'm a bit concerned about their dividend safety.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to that post. I'm obviously, they're in my portfolio, so it's definitely something I will read with intent and interest.
Good. So this brings us to the end of the show. Phil, thank you very much for being here with us today. I hope it went well for you as well. I mean, it's for us an honor to have the dividend quiz winner on the show, and you've proven to be very knowledgeable on the quiz, and I must say today as well, again, the podcast. So thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, it's been great having you. As I said earlier, you beat me in the quiz, so worthy winner. Delighted to have you on. I know we've chatted before, and we love chatting to you, and you have so much knowledge to give, so hopefully we'll have you on again. But thanks for coming on, and to all our listeners again, thanks very much for listening to us, and we'll see you next week.